You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive help supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI. It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Faculty and students at Rochester Institute of Technology recently built a robot fish. Why? Because it could lead to a new wave of prosthetics. Now everyone's hooked. At RIT, the creative team of engineers is on to something life-changing. Learn more about the project at rit.edu/kick. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Shortly after graduating from Harvard University and just days before 9/11, Seth Moulton enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps. He thought he had signed up to go to Afghanistan and fight Al-Qaeda, but instead, he found himself fighting a different war just a year after 9/11 when he was an infantry platoon commander in the 1st Company of Marines to enter Baghdad. Though he personally opposed the war in Iraq, he kept returning for a total of 4 deployments because he says he didn't want someone less experienced to have to take his place. He received a Bronze Star and the Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medal for his bravery in Iraq, but he kept it a secret for years, not even telling his own parents. Seth Moulton chalks it up to his lifelong belief in service, the same value that he says led him to become a U.S. congressman and now to run for president in 2020. And today, Congressman Moulton joins me on the podcast to discuss what he sees as his path to the Democratic nomination, warns against his party's embrace of socialism, and says he's not afraid to bring up Donald Trump and impeachment in the primary. He recalls his military service in Iraq, including reaching out as a special liaison to tribal leaders in southern Iraq, and what it taught him about compromise and bipartisanship. He reveals why he turned down the premium health insurance afforded members of Congress in favor of getting his health care at the Veterans Administration, what he's learned about what works and what doesn't work at the VA, and why he's against a single-payer health care program. Plus, we talk about abolishing the Electoral College, what it's like to campaign for president with an infant daughter, and how he became the star of a popular Iraqi TV show, Moulton and Mohammed. Coming up with Congressman Seth Moulton in just a moment. After graduating from Harvard University, Seth Moulton joined the Marines and served 4 tours of duty in Iraq, receiving a Bronze Star and the Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medal before retiring from the military with the rank of captain. After returning to Harvard for graduate school, he spent some time in the private sector until he says he felt the call to return to public service and ran for Congress, defeating a 9-term incumbent to become the representative for Massachusetts' 6th District, where he's served since 2015. Now, as of this week, he's added presidential candidate to his resume, announcing his campaign for the Democratic nomination in 2020, and he joins me today to talk about it. Congressman Seth Moulton, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here.
You just announced, I think on Monday.
A few days ago.
Yeah, and you've already been to Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina over the past, what, 3 or 4 days.
And Nevada's next. So we're hitting all the early primary states in the first week. It's an exciting tour. And we're starting on the ground with service events. The first event I did was up in New Hampshire at an amazing place called Liberty House in Manchester that helps veterans get back on their feet. We help them spread mulch, stock their food pantry, and sort clothes for the veterans. We worked alongside veterans, and we supported the work of this institution that's doing amazing work to get veterans reintegrated back into the community.
Now, you come from Massachusetts, which is right next door to New Hampshire, and of course, 84% of New Hampshire is within the Boston media market. Is that where you see your best chance at an early win?
Well, I will be spending a lot of time in New Hampshire, but I'll be spending time on the ground in all the early primary states. This is a grassroots campaign, and we're starting with veterans and students especially, but we're talking to voters to earn their trust and gain support over time.
Among the 20 or so candidates running, who do you think is going to be trying to occupy the same space as you? Or let me phrase it a different way. Who do you need to take out first?
Well, so far, no one is really talking about the issues I'm focused on, which is taking on Donald Trump as commander-in-chief, on his performance on keeping our country strong and safe, on what it means to have a secure America, and what our foreign policy, our national security policy should look like. These are issues where I think he's actually weakest, and we're not going to defeat him if not willing as Democrats to take him on these issues and talk about how we would lead the country in the world.
Yeah, there's been a little bit of a debate within the Democratic Party as to whether you take on Trump in the primary or whether you don't. You're not one of those who's afraid to talk about him in the primary. Do you campaign against your opponents or do you campaign against Donald Trump?
You campaign by talking about what your vision is for the country, about how I think that everybody in America should have access to affordable health care, but we shouldn't force people onto a government plan designed in 1963. I'm for a public option, like Obama was fighting for under Obamacare, that competes with private options, but I'm not going to force people off their private health care plan if that's what they like to have. And I say that as the only candidate in the race who gets single-payer health care because I made a commitment to continue getting my own health care at the VA, even as a member of Congress. I'm going to talk about how we need to prepare for the jobs of the new economy, not the old. A lot of the old jobs are just not coming back, but there's a lot of work we can do to make sure that we're ready and competitive in the new jobs, the green tech jobs, the jobs in advanced manufacturing, the ways that we can lead the world in the new economy. And I'm going to talk about what we need to do to make our country safe at home and abroad. Some of our national security issues, like whether or not we're giving foreign aid to Central America, are critical to our domestic security as well. That's what we should be doing to counter the flow of migrants to the southern border. There are a lot of migrants coming from Central America, but rather than cut aid to Central America, as Trump has done, we should be reinforcing it just like we did in Colombia, which turned a narco state into a tourist destination in the course of 15 years. So I'm going to talk about how we can lead this country forward, both at home and abroad, but I'm not going to be afraid to take on Donald Trump in the process.
Now, one wouldn't think that Massachusetts has a lot in common with Trump country, but Massachusetts has had to deal with many of the same problems confronting the more conservative Rust Belt states, such as the loss of manufacturing jobs and the opioid crisis, which has hit your state particularly hard. Does that give you some sense of what's driving the white, blue-collar Democrats and independents who went to Trump and how you might get them back?
It does. It does. I think a lot of people are feeling so left behind by the changes in our economy, by the opioid crisis, and by other things. And they just look at Washington and see that Washington isn't doing anything that we need to change. And frankly, I think many of them feel betrayed by our political leaders there. And I know that feeling because it reminds me of how I felt in Iraq. I was very proud to serve the country and to be a United States Marine, but I disagreed with the war. And when I saw the Bush administration in particular making political decisions totally out of touch with us on the ground, it was a terrible feeling. It felt like my country's leaders were leaving us behind. I think that's the way a lot of people feel across the country. And they voted for someone who just promised to shake up the system. Now, the truth of the matter, of course, is that that Trump has led the most corrupt administration in American history. We don't even have a sitting Secretary of Defense. We haven't had one for months. He's gone through cabinet officials. It seems like that's the pace of one a week or something. So Trump has not done a good job of living up to his promises, but he did take on the Washington establishment, and that's what we need to have in our nominee as well. Someone who is willing to take on the Washington establishment and get the country back working for Americans again.
Now, you mentioned your service in Iraq. You enlisted in the Marines just before 9/11, and I think it was just about a year later, you were an infantry platoon commander in the first company of Marines to enter Baghdad. I'm assuming that those were still the days of shock and awe when we thought it was just going to be a four-week war. How long did it take for reality to set in and you realized that this was not going to be a cakewalk?
Well, that summer was pretty good. Things were going really well in Iraq that summer. In some ways, I've never seen a more hopeful, excited, and optimistic place on Earth. But it quickly became apparent that we had no plan. We had no plan for the occupation. The invasion was a success, but we had no idea what to do next. And that's when things started to fall apart. But the crazy thing about my own experience is that, yes, I signed up a little bit before 9/11, so I didn't even expect to be in a war at all. And then, of course, 9/11 happened. There were lines outside recruiting stations, and I was proud that I'd made the decision before. But I went through training in 2002, and all of us thought that we had just missed the war. We thought that Afghanistan would be much like the Persian Gulf War or something, in and out.
Yeah.
And so the whole time we thought we had just missed the war. Little did we know that we'd be going to Iraq. Then we got to Kuwait, sailed over from San Diego. In fact, I got a call from my battalion commander on Christmas Eve 2002, and he said, you gotta get out here in a week. So enjoy Christmas. Make sure you get a will. And I'll see you out here in California.
Wow.
We got on ships a few days after I arrived and sailed over to Kuwait. And then I just didn't think that Bush was actually going to invade.
Oh, really?
We took bets as lieutenants. And I was on the side of, no, this is just a show of force. He's not actually going to invade Iraq. But then, of course, a couple weeks later, that's exactly what we did.
Interesting. And I think you ended up doing four tours there.
I did. And people ask, you know, why would you keep going back to a war that you disagreed
with?
Because I was an outspoken critic of how we were carrying out the war.
Mm-hmm.
I was in this movie, No End in Sight, in the middle of my deployments.
Sure, yeah.
Talking about where we had gone wrong. But I didn't want anyone to go in my place. And I think that's the way a lot of us felt. One of the most powerful stories that I remember from that time is a good friend of mine in the Marines named Joe, who had done two deployments. He got out of the Marines, and when he got out, he also came out of the closet. This was before the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yeah.
And so he had to keep this fundamental part of himself hidden while he was in the Marines. But then, a few months later, he got a notice in the mail that he was getting called back for the surge. And he and I talked about it. All he had to do was make one quick call and say two words to the Department of Defense, I'm gay, and he wouldn't have had to go. But he didn't do it.
Wow.
He went back into the closet so that no one had to go in his place and did a third deployment.
Wow.
That's the spirit of America that I saw. Even in the midst of this war that many of us disagreed with, I saw the best of America. At the same time, though, I think we saw some of the worst of America in Washington.
Now, I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't mention that you were the star of a hit Iraqi television series, Molten and Mohammed. What was that? Some kind of detective show or what?
No, it was sort of like a 60 Minutes in Iraq.
It was an
investigative journalism show. We were trying to show the Iraqis how to have a free press. And one of the ways we did this is by putting our own show together to serve as a model. And strangely, it became incredibly popular. And I haven't run into someone who remembers me from Molten and Mohammed in the last hour. Literally, someone an hour ago,
oh, really?
An Iraqi who's moved to the United States, he saw me. He said, I know you. I said, I think it's from the TV show. He said, yes, that's right. I saw you on TV. So it was a very popular show. And it was the first taste that Iraqis had of a free press, of investigative journalism. It's something that the Marine Corps believed we had to teach the Iraqis if they were going to develop a democracy.
Now, whatever became of Mohammed, did you two have some kind of Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis falling out or what?
Mohammed is still a very, very close close friend. Okay. I was just emailing with him last night. He actually came to America on a Fulbright scholarship, and then he had to stay because sadly his family was threatened, threatened to be killed by the insurgents because of his work with the Americans. And so it would have been a death sentence for him to go home. And so my friends and I helped him complete his asylum application, and he's now happily living here in America as a very proud American citizen.
And I think it was just a few years later that a former guest of the show, General David Petraeus, had you assigned to work as a special liaison with tribal leaders in southern Iraq. What did you learn from that experience?
Well, it was an incredible job. We were trying to get tribal leaders who, frankly, were working hard to kill Americans to instead switch sides and work on protecting the country. And it taught me a lot about working with people you disagree with. It taught me a lot about getting things done with folks that don't agree with you on a lot of things and maybe have a lot of ideological differences. But what we were able to do with those Iraqi tribal sheikhs is find some common ground about building a better, stronger future. And that's exactly what we need to do in Washington. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm proud of the fact that I'm one of the most bipartisan members of Congress. In these very partisan times, people like to say, well, maybe you should be more partisan and just fight for your own team. But the way that I became the most effective freshman Democrat, in fact, was because I was willing to work across the aisle to get things done. And that's the same spirit that I think we need to bring to this presidential race.
Well, given that the liberal wing of the Democratic Party seems to be gaining steam and the party is even flirting with socialism in a way that I haven't seen in my lifetime, do you worry that your bipartisan record might become a cudgel for your opponents to use against you?
They might try to use it against me, but it's something I'm proud of, and I think it's something that the American people understand. The first bill I passed was the Faster Care for Veterans Act to help veterans get better access, quicker access to health care at the VA. And the only way it actually got passed into law is with Republican support. It was hard. It was hard to find common ground, even on something as simple as getting care for veterans, because there were a lot of different constituencies. Some people wanted it to happen outside the VA. Some people wanted it to happen through the VA. It was a complicated process, but because I was willing to work with Republicans, not all, I mean, you know, you have to choose your Republicans. You have to choose ones you can actually work with. But because I was able to do that, it got passed into law and is making a difference in veterans' lives. And I think that's a mistake that some of our party leaders are making even today, which is passing a whole bunch of laws that get through on Democratic votes in the House, but never have a chance of actually becoming law by getting through the Senate and being signed by the president. And therefore, they sadly don't make any difference in Americans' lives.
Yeah, and on that issue, I do want to give you credit. Apparently, you walk the walk, and instead of taking the platinum health care plan offered to most congressmen, you get your health care at the VA still, right?
I do. I made that commitment to continue going to the VA like all my fellow veterans and fellow Marines I served with. I said, look, until we fix this system, I'm going to go to it just like all the rest of you. And my experience has been mixed, and it gives me a real insight into this healthcare debate that we're having right now as a party and as a country. It's why I don't want to force people off their private plans if they actually think they're getting good healthcare right now. Mm-hmm. But it's why I want a public option, whether it's Medicare for all or a more modern version of Medicare, which I think would be even better, competing against those private plans to lower healthcare costs and improve healthcare outcomes for all Americans. I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly at the VA. They have a great prescription drug program, for example, that actually negotiates prices with pharmaceutical companies, which Medicare doesn't do.
Yeah.
It actually, it works great, and it's something that's a real hallmark of the VA. But at the same time, the first time I got surgery at the VA, it was a minor surgery. I had a hernia from lifting. I went in, I checked into the hospital, and they couldn't even find me in their record system.
Oh, wow. That's not good.
20 minutes, they said, we can't prove that you're a veteran, so we'll consider taking you as a humanitarian case. I sat down next to another veteran, an older gentleman in the waiting room, and he said he'd been waiting there for 5 hours just to be seen.
Wow.
After I got my surgery, they sent me home with the wrong medications. So there are a lot of problems with single-payer health care that I know because I get it today. There are also some things we can learn, and I think that a competitive system where different health care plans compete for Americans, that's exactly the kind of system that will give us the best outcomes. But that does set me apart from many other people in my party.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Congressman Seth Moulton when we come back in just a minute. If you don't know SiriusXM, then listen up. SiriusXM brings you the deepest variety of commercial-free music for every genre and for every mood, where you hear the biggest names in talk, entertainment, and comedy, where you get news from every source. A lot of people think you need a car to enjoy SiriusXM, but you don't. You can listen outside the car. Right now, you can get your first 3 months of SiriusXM outside the car for just $1. Just go to SiriusXM.com/kick to see offer details and subscribe. For $1, you can listen to SiriusXM on your phone, at home, and online. So anywhere you are, any time of day, you can hear your favorite songs or discover new ones. Go to Sirius, S-I-R-I-U-S, XM.com/kick and get your first 3 months of SiriusXM outside the car for $1. See offer details, offer available to new SiriusXM streaming subscribers. SiriusXM, no car required. Don't miss Hulu's all-new original series, Rami, now streaming only on Hulu. Based on the real-life experiences of comedian Rami Youssef, this groundbreaking comedy series takes viewers into the world of a first-generation American Muslim on a spiritual journey in his politically divided New Jersey neighborhood. Rami brings a fresh, new perspective to the screen as the series explores the challenges of what it's like to be caught between an Egyptian community that considers life a moral test and a millennial generation that thinks life has little to no consequences. The series features postmodern meditations on love, work, and identity through the eyes of a modern-day Muslim-American millennial and his family, and explores how challenging it can be to find deeper meaning in today's hyper-connected world. Be sure to catch Hulu's all-new original comedy series, Rami. All episodes now streaming only on Hulu. And now, back to the podcast. When you were in Iraq, you received a Bronze Star and the Marine Corps Commendation Medal, but I was surprised to learn that you kept those secret for a number of years. In fact, I don't think you even told your parents. Why?
Well, I don't think veterans should just come back and tell war stories. Mm-hmm. I think that all of us were proud of what we did, but those of us who were really on the ground and went through the worst stuff, we don't need to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
We just have that quiet pride in knowing that we serve the country. And frankly, I saw a lot of Marines, often guys younger than me, do truly heroic things that they weren't awarded for. And so I never wanted to go around wearing those medals on my chest.
Yeah, I don't think anyone who has actually been in a war comes back wanting to glorify it.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. It's a difficult duty. It's a solemn duty. It's a duty that we were proud to do so no one had to go in our places. But it's also a duty that I hope we can prevent other Americans from having to do in the future.
Yeah.
And that's fundamentally why I ran for Congress in the first place, is to help prevent some of what I saw in Iraq from happening again.
When you ran for Congress, you took on a 9-term incumbent backed by the party establishment in Massachusetts and overcame a 54-point deficit to win. That's pretty incredible. I mean, with those odds stacked against you, what made you even want to take that on in the first place?
I just thought it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I thought back to a tough day in 2004 when a young Marine in my platoon looked up at me and said, sir, you ought to run for Congress someday so that this stuff doesn't happen again.
Hmm.
Now, he used a Marine term for stuff, but you can understand what I mean. And he was right. The system isn't going to change if we're not willing to take it on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I took on this 18-year incumbent. I probably didn't know much about politics. I didn't know much about politics back then. I mean, I didn't have any family background in politics. Or I hadn't been involved and hadn't studied it in school. And so, so I probably thought it'd be
thing?
Well, I think I probably didn't realize how hard it would be to take on an 18-year incumbent. we did that first poll after 7 months. So we'd already been on the campaign trail for 7 months, and I was still 54 points down. So it took a lot of work. It was a tough race. But I think it made me a better congressman for having gone through that.
And one of the things that I find most amazing about your run for Congress is usually candidates who successfully primary an incumbent do so by moving to the extreme right or the extreme left of their opponent and campaigning to well, let's be honest, the wingnuts in the party. You didn't do that. In fact, you admitted that ideologically there wasn't much daylight between you and your opponent. So how do you win by not attacking the incumbent? I mean, how do you distinguish yourself in a debate between two guys who pretty much agree with each other?
Well, my strategy was to say, I'm going to get things done.
Okay.
I think that he was too partisan, unwilling to work with any Republicans, and that's why he'd only passed one bill in 18 years. One bill in 18 years.
Wow. That's pretty remarkable.
And he said, look, we can do better than this. And we can do it by being willing to find common ground. Never giving up our principles, but being willing to find common ground to get things done. And that's what I promised to do. And that's what I've delivered for the people I represent.
And another thing that distinguishes you in that race is you were the first ever political endorsement from General Stanley McChrystal, also another guest of the show. How did you pull that off? Did you know him from Iraq or what?
I actually didn't know him from Iraq. I got to know him through our joint advocacy for national service.
Okay.
I think our country would be a stronger country, a more united country, if more young people had the opportunity to serve. Not just in the military. I don't think we should expand the size of the military. But I do think we should give kids more opportunities to serve here at home through AmeriCorps, programs like City Year, Peace Corps. There are great opportunities to serve the country, but there aren't enough of them. There are more people who apply. Last time I checked, 5.5 applicants for every one AmeriCorps slot. So there are a lot of young people who are actually ready and willing to serve the country, but they just don't have that opportunity yet today. And it was through this work that I got to know General McChrystal, and he became not just a friend but a mentor, someone that I turned to for advice, and I was so proud to have his endorsement in that first race.
Do you think you'll get his endorsement for president?
Well, I haven't asked for it yet.
No.
Isn't
he a Republican?
No, he's not.
Oh, he's not? Okay.
No, he's not. But
maybe I'm thinking of Petraeus then. I'm not sure.
You know, they both really try to stay above the partisan fray.
Sure.
Just talk about what's best for the country. And in some ways, I think that's why both General McChrystal and General Petraeus have been such great mentors to me.
A few months ago, you were among the handful of younger Democrats who opposed Nancy Pelosi's reelection as Speaker of the House. Given that superdelegates still hold significant sway over the Democratic nomination, and of course a lot of them come from the party's old guard, do you have any concern that your opposing Pelosi could come back to haunt you?
No, I know it was the right thing to do, and we were never just opposing Pelosi. We were opposing the top three party leaders, of whom are men. But look, I think it's time for a new generation of leadership in our party. And I'm not someone who just says that. I'm someone who's willing to fight for it. I fought for it across the country in helping so many people get elected to the House. My Serve America organization endorsed and supported 21 out of the 40 seats that we flipped to take back the House. So a huge effort. And we went to many districts that were tough, where people were frustrated with the Washington establishment. And that's why at the end of the day, we have to be willing to take on the Washington establishment. Now, as a result of having this debate, we got the climate change subcommittee, we got the voting rights subcommittee, we got an agreement from leadership on term limits that will give this new generation an opportunity to lead in the very near future. And we also gave Speaker Pelosi the votes that she needed to get elected speaker because she didn't have them without us. And it prevented the Democrats, who had won these tough races, from having to vote for her after they only got elected by promising to vote against her. So at the end of the day, the compromise that we reached, which is part of succeeding in politics, is being able to find some of those compromises. It's made the country stronger. It's made the party stronger. And it's given us the opportunity to be a party that's not just good at standing up against Trump, which Speaker Pelosi has been doing a fantastic job of doing, by the way, but also a party that people will look to and say, that's the future. I can see the future of the country in their party, in that party leadership.
And yet, if you look at the polls, the two guys at the top are Bernie and Biden, who are, you know, the oldest candidates on the list. How do you run against those two?
Well, Bernie has injected some great ideas into this debate, and he did that in 2016 as well. I mean, we wouldn't have been even talking about college loans, I don't think, if he hadn't been a part of the race. And sitting here as a member of Congress still paying his college loans, that's something that I really appreciate. But I do worry that that some of his plans are they're socialist plans. They're not Democratic plans. He is a socialist himself, and I don't think that that's what Americans at the end of the day want to vote for. So we have some disagreements there. Now, Vice President Biden has been a mentor and a friend.
Oh, really?
And he was one of the first people to come out and support my first campaign. So I was after I won the primary, but he was right there for me then. And we're going to have a good debate. We're going to have a good debate. But I do think it's a time for next generation thinking in our national security, in our economic security, talking about how we can succeed in the new economy, not the old, talking about how we lead in this new world where we're not worried about Russia rolling tanks into Western Europe, but we are worried about the fact that Russia attacks us through the internet and tries to undermine our democracy, where the current sitting president is trying to build a fifth century wall on the southern border. But the place where we actually need a wall is between us and China on the internet, because China every single day steals our business ideas and military secrets through the internet. So we should be talking about a cyber wall, not a southern border wall. This is about preparing ourselves for the next 50 years, not going back to the past, but looking forward. And that's what I would do as the next president.
And speaking of Russia, there's this debate among Democrats right now as to whether it's time to impeach the president and whether impeachment actually helps or hurts Democrats in 2020. Where do you stand?
Well, I just think that it's the right thing to do to have this debate. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm saying we should vote on this tomorrow. In fact, we don't even have all the facts yet. We don't have the full Mueller report, for example.
True.
But even a year ago, it was apparent that there is enough evidence of wrongdoing by this administration, by Trump and his close associates, that we should have this debate in the Congress. It's our constitutional responsibility to have this debate. And so I broke with most people in my party and the party leadership last year in voting for impeachment discussions, for impeachment debate. I think that was the right thing to do, and I think it was a mistake to wait until this long. I think we've kind of backed ourselves into a corner now. So I've been very clear on this. We have a constitutional responsibility to act as a check on the executive and to investigate what Trump and his administration have done. And whether or not that's good politics is not as important as the oath that we swore to protect and defend the Constitution.
But even if the House actually votes to impeach, there's little chance that it's going to pass the Senate. So isn't any impeachment proceeding just going to be theater?
No, it's not theater. Mm-hmm. It's about fulfilling our constitutional responsibilities.
Okay.
And it's having this debate in a transparent way before the American people. You know, I think if you had asked this question at this time in the whole Nixon debate, people would have said the same thing. He'll never get convicted by the Senate. It's not going to go anywhere. But by having those discussions, by bringing the facts to light, not just for Congress, but for the American people, ultimately, Nixon resigned because the writing was on the wall. It was very clear that he had violated the law and betrayed Americans' trust. We need to have that discussion about this president as well.
Now, if impeachment came to a vote in the House today, do you know how you'd vote?
Well, I wouldn't say, because it has, I think we have to have this debate first. In fact, this is what the Republicans did in the last Congress, is they forced us to vote on all sorts of things before having a debate. And we never even had a debate about repealing Obamacare before they would have votes on it. So that's not the way Congress is supposed to work. We do two things in Congress. We debate things and then we vote on them. We need to have the debate first. And that's why I think we should have started this debate last year.
And among the proposals that you've set forth, you've proposed abolishing the Electoral College. Given what happened in the last election, it's totally understandable. I mean, every vote should actually count. But here's what I worry about. I worry about the implementation. If you switch to a popular vote where candidates then truly have to run a national campaign and compete in every state, doesn't it create a situation where massive media buys replace retail politics and only billionaires can run for president? And beyond that, if every vote really does matter, aren't we then setting ourselves up for endless recounts and the 2000 elections times 50?
No, we're not. Every vote counting is a fundamental principle of our democracy, and it's simply not the case in America today. The Electoral College, as you explained, means that presidential candidates only go to a few states. They don't even bother going to most of the country. And most of the country knows that, you know, their electoral vote is going to go a certain way in their state. And so their individual vote doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wrong. A lot of people in congressional elections know that their votes don't matter because of gerrymandering. And so I've called for an end to gerrymandering as well. And I've also been a staunch advocate ever since my first campaign of getting money out of politics. This is something that, I mean, look, is there a concern that there's too much money in politics today? Absolutely. And is your concern valid that that we could change the system in a way that would favor the wealthy? Maybe it is. I'm not sure. But one thing is clear. We need to work as Americans to get big money out of politics. And that's something that I would fight for as the president, just the same way I fought for it in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself taking any kind of a pledge to only take donations of a certain amount the way Bernie did last time around?
So I've made a pledge to not take any corporate PAC money.
Okay.
And I'm proud of that. I've also been working on campaign finance reform legislation, and I was very proud to be endorsed by Larry Lessig back in my first congressional campaign. He's very selective, but he's a leader on campaign finance reform issues, and I was proud to be among his few endorsees. The point is that we need fundamental reform of our electoral system to give people trust back in their government, in their leaders, and in their vote. In these last midterms, there are a lot of people in Georgia who were disenfranchised, who know that their vote for governor and lieutenant governor didn't count. And that is wrong. One of the amazing candidates that I supported is a good friend from the Marines, Dan McCready, who ran in North Carolina. And because his Republican opponent committed election fraud and disenfranchised a whole bunch of people whose votes should have counted, he now has to run another campaign. Hmm. And so even today in 2019, there are places in America where votes don't count, and we've got to change that.
Well, before we go, I know that you're also a recent father. Congratulations on
that.
Thank you
very much. I'm very excited.
Have you and your wife figured out how to campaign for president with a six-month-old baby girl in tow?
No, we haven't. It's tough. No. It's tough. And I'll bet. Works and I work. We're fortunate that my parents live nearby our home in Massachusetts, and we get a lot of help. But it's tough being two working parents. But I'll tell you, we love our little girl, Emmy, more than you can imagine. She's doing so well. We're so proud of her. And I miss her every time I'm on the campaign trail. That, frankly, is why I couldn't get in this race earlier. I wasn't going to get in the race any earlier with a six-month-old at home. But I thought long and hard about this because I do miss her every single day I'm away. But I also think that I'd like to think, at least, that she'd be proud that her father was out trying to change the country, to make this country a better and stronger. I don't want her growing up into a world led by someone like Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. We need to do better than this. I know America is better than this. I believe America is better than this. And that's why I'm running for country. And that's why I'm running for president.
And for the country.
To serve this country, absolutely.
Well, I wish you the very best with the campaign and with your baby daughter. Real quickly, where can folks go to learn more about you?
Go to www.sethmoulton.com. That's SethMoulton.com. Watch the video that explains a little bit of my background and why I'm in this race. And then make a small donation. If you want to hear any of these ideas on the debate stage, which have got to be a part of our debate if we're going to really take on Donald Trump, then please make a small donation, $5, $10, even $1, just to help me get on the debate stage in June.
Good stuff. Well, Congressman Seth Moulton, good luck, and thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Congressman Seth Moulton for coming on the podcast. To learn more about him or to volunteer or donate to his campaign, visit SethMoulton.com. If you don't know SiriusXM, then listen up. Commercial-free music plus sports, talk, comedy, and news, they have it all. And right now, you can get your first 3 months of SiriusXM outside the car for just $1. Go to SiriusXM.com/kick to see offer details and subscribe. That's Sirius, SiriusXM.com/kick. Offer available to new SiriusXM streaming subscribers. SiriusXM, no car required. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.